Excuse me, may I talk to you for a second? Yes. This is the Black Real Estate Dialogue. And the purpose of the Black Real Estate Dialogue is to document the journey of an up-and-coming real estate investor and to share the stories of successful Black real estate investors.
This episode is sponsored by Section 8 Rentals Made Easy. For years, Section 8 Rentals have been one of the best ways to make money in real estate, but most people overlook the program because they've never had a guide show them how to easily navigate the system and get paid. In this ebook, you will learn how to make your property available for Section 8, how to pass the inspection, and how to get paychecks rolling in like clockwork. Visit Section8RentalsMadeEasy.com or click the link in the show notes to get your copy today.
So you want to start a podcast, huh? Well, we got something to help you. The Black Real Estate Dialogue brings you the How to Start a Successful Podcast on a Budget with No Experience ebook and webinar bundle.
We are controlling transmission.
Come and put info into action as we show you the step-by-step process to sharing your successful podcast on a budget. This bundle is full of the exact details, social media hacks, and podcasting process we've used to gain 13,000 downloads and over 10,000 Instagram followers. But that's not all. As a bonus, you'll receive the exact super trackers we use to stay organized and free access to our private Facebook group designed to help you execute. Make sure you click that link now because there is an audience for you to reach. The How to Start a Successful Podcast on a Budget with No Experience, the ebook and webinar bundle presented by the Black Real Estate Dialogue. Do you really think investing in real estate is too expensive? Well, you wrong about that. Presenting a beginner's guide to buying your first out-of-state property, a Black Real Estate Dialogue course. That's right, it's the new course presented by the Black Real Estate Dialogue, teaching you how to develop the investor's mindset, the advantages of investing out of state, getting your finances in order, finding the right location, assembling your team, creating financing strategies, how to find and analyze properties, how to find tenants, real-life case studies, and so much more in bonus content.
Oh yeah, did we mention you have lifetime access?
My goodness! If you have dreams of buying a property out of state but have no idea where to start, well, this is the guide for you. Learn the tips from someone with firsthand experience. Are you looking for a community of like-minded individuals and access to experts in real estate?
Yeah.
Are you interested in real estate but need more support and guidance?
You know who it is?
The Black Real Estate Dialogue presents the Real Estate Investing Community. No matter how much or how little real estate experience you have, we've created a community for you because your perspective is important. All right, tell me, what's the number one place where you can do Q&A with experienced guest speakers 3 times a month? How about unlimited access to past guest speakers' recordings? What about a private Slack channel to engage in daily discussion with everybody in the community to share resources and support each other? Head on over to gumroad.com/bread. That's gumroad.com/BRED. It's the Real Estate Investing Community presented by the Black Real Estate Dialogue. Come join us today.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast, episode 63. Several announcements before we get into today's episode. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe on whichever platforms you're listening to this on. This will definitely help us move up in the rankings and also help us to reach more people. If you'd like to get the latest updates on what's happening at the Black Real Estate Dialogue, text BRED to 21,000 to join our free VIP text list. If you'd like to gain early access to episodes, bonus content, discounts on merch, and more, join our Patreon program. Visit patreon.com/blackrealestatedialogue to join, or visit the link in our show notes. Also, if you'd like to join the Bread Real Estate Investing Community, our promotion price of $19.99 per month will go up to $30 per month on Friday, March 5th. We have bi-monthly masterclasses taught by experienced investors, a private Slack channel, access to all past recordings, and more. So definitely, if you'd like to join, click the link in the show notes, and you'll be able to do that before the price goes up. So this week, I had my first tenant issue as a self-manager. Basically, what happened is that my tenant emailed me on a Sunday night, letting me know that she had no heat. And I'll be honest, I kind of panicked. I didn't really know what to do. However, I remembered I have boots on the ground. I have people there who I know. And so I text a woman who I know and just let her know what the situation was. She gave me the number of a heating company. They were not able to go out on the Sunday night. So unfortunately, the tenant was, you know, in our home with space heaters and such for Sunday night, but they got there Monday. I think they replaced the filter and also the igniter as well. So obviously, you know, that cost, but I'm glad that I was able to do that and take care of that for her. And it really shows that, you know, you can take care of things from long distance. And so I just want to encourage you all that, you know, if you are a long distance investor, or you want to be a long distance investor, and you decide to not go with the property manager, you know, if you have people on the ground, if you have a network, it's definitely possible to still take care of things. And so it was a little daunting, was a little bit scary, but thankfully, through the power of a great network, I was able to get it done. This episode is sponsored by Section 8 Rentals Made Easy. For years, Section 8 Rentals have been one of the best ways to make money in real estate, but most people overlook the program because they've never had a guide to show them how to easily navigate the system and get paid. In this ebook, you'll learn how to make your property available for Section 8, how to pass the inspection, and how to get paychecks rolling in like clockwork. Click the link in the show notes to get your copy today. Without further ado, let's get into this episode. I'm very excited for you all to learn. And so let me know what you think. But without further ado, let's get into it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue podcast. I'm very excited about this episode. Here with me today, I have Raquel Timmons out of Seattle, Washington. Raquel, thank you so much for joining the show today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. Excited to share.
Definitely. And I'm particularly excited because, you know, this is a new episode for us. This is something new for us, something that our people are not really exposed to, is the real estate development side of things. So I'm excited to get into that. And I guess with that, Raquel, could you just give us an overview of who you are, where you're from, and everything?
Sure. So Raquel Timmons, I was born in the Midwest, but raised in Seattle, Washington, and have a unique backstory. But in short, I actually worked full time during high school. And that led into working full time in college. And I was a math kid, so I always thought I was going to do finance. And so that was kind of my trajectory all the way up until I had to take an evening class one quarter. And I think it was my junior year or so. And at that time, on that first day of class, I walk in and the professor had topo maps on the desk or topography maps. Maybe some of your followers don't know. But anyway, they had topo maps on these desks and had Legos on the topo maps. And they were like, build a city. I'm like, oh, people do this for a living? Oh, yeah, this is my calling. This is where money and, you know, kind of our societal issues and the built environment all kind of come together. And I knew it was my home. And so I eventually got into real estate, started working for a small time developer who did single family luxury homes. And that was right before the downturn. They went out of business, unfortunately. And so I got stuck in an urban planning role. And I say stuck, but I really enjoyed it for about 10 years until I repositioned myself into the private sector, or back into the private sector. So anyway, been in the private sector for about 5 years. And maybe this was a long way to answer your question about how I got here. But now I'm the senior vice president for a small boutique development firm. Even though we're small, we have very, very large projects. And so I manage most of our acquisitions and due diligence and programming for all of our projects. I do special initiatives, which we can dive into if you like. I also act as our government liaison, our industry liaison, our community liaison. And then I also participate on our marketing team. So high level background on Raquel.
Yeah. So you got a full plate. That's for sure.
Full plate. No one day is the same.
That's awesome. So I guess from an education perspective, what was your path like through college and such? Like what did you have to end up focusing on in order to get into this field?
Yeah, it's a good question. I started off as an econ major. Like I said, I was a finance kid and just knew I was going to be in finance. I actually bought real estate really young. I was 18 when I bought my first piece of real estate. So I always knew real estate was going to be like in my portfolio, but I was going to be a passive investor. Mm-hmm. I just wasn't very passionate about it. Yeah. Until I took that class. And so I picked up urban planning as a minor, and I eventually went back and got my MBA during my time at the city of Renton. But to be honest, most people in our field come from all different directions. I mean, our industry, no one's the same. I have folks that came from a law background. There are people who came from physical therapy backgrounds, culinary backgrounds. It's just interesting how the industry attracts different people. So I don't know that there's one single approach to coming into the industry, but that was mine.
Definitely. And how would, for those who maybe are not familiar, how would you define, like in your terms, like what commercial real estate is?
Oh, God. I mean, it's a varied concept. I mean, commercial real estate is essentially assets that are bigger than, so most of your folks and followers are residential, right? Single family mm-hmm. residential. So if you think about almost all other real estate asset classes are commercial real estate. So you have multifamily, and that can be broken down into different types. You could have garden walk-up multifamily. You can have mid-rise multifamily. You can have high-rise multifamily. Office is another asset class of commercial real estate. Industrial, institutional, like hospitals or schools. Who else am I? Oh, hospitality, obviously. I don't know how I forgot that. We actually own a hotel. So hospitality, retail is another asset or a food group. So the commercial real estate industry itself is a very, very large industry. And then there are several different functions within that industry and all of those varied asset classes. So it's a pretty broad lane to try and define.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And what excites you the most about the industry?
Well, for me, it's really around scale. You know, I mean, the industry is big and it's a huge economic engine. I mean, everything you see is in the built environment, in most cases beyond single family. Mm-hmm. Somebody has constructed it. Somebody owns it. Somebody is reaping returns on it. So it's a huge economic engine. For me personally, I really love the creation of space, like how our families come together, how we shop, how we entertain, how we work. And then I also like seeing my fingerprints, like in the built environment. Like I can drive down the street and be like, oh yeah, I did that. Or, you know, like something about that really gets me going. Mm-hmm. So I would probably say scale is one. And then if I'm just going to be honest, obviously the money. I was an urban planner for many, many years, and you get to touch a lot of the built environment, but you don't really touch the money, and not even from a philosophical standpoint. Like there's, if you can't underwrite a project, no matter how great of an idea you have, if you can't underwrite it, then that's a problem. You need to understand the money piece. And then I want a piece of the pie. Like I want to make some money too. So I think that's probably what excites me most about it is the scale and the money.
For sure. So when it comes to like residential and commercial, it seems to be like a disconnect. People get confused. Yeah. Like what would you say are some similarities? What would you say are like a couple of differences between the two?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, there are a ton of similarities. So maybe I'll start with the differences. In that commercial real estate is a much more sophisticated business model. You know, there are a lot of elements that play into either getting a project underwritten or off the ground or managed properly. And so in that sense, and just given the amount of money that goes into these projects, it's a different type of business model. So I would start there. Obviously, I've described a lot of the assets. I mean, there's so many different assets. Residential, you know what it is. It's going to be a house. It's going to have a roof. I mean, like there's just these certain elements of the project that are going to all be the same. Commercial projects, just given the difference in assets, you're going to have a different approach for every asset. And then on top of that, as I mentioned, the functions are a lot different. So, I mean, there's a lot of money here, right? For example, the project that I'm sitting in right now is a $1 billion project, right? That money has to get spent down somewhere. Like people are getting paid for that, right? Mm-hmm. So those functions are separated out a lot more in commercial as compared to residential. For example, you could be in residential your own contractor, you could be your own architect. Sometimes people try to be their own electrician. You're going to be your own property manager. You might be your own attorney, you know, like you're going to try to basically in-house all of those functions. Commercial real estate, we rely heavily on expertise and you just go outhouse for all of that. Unless you're a really big company and you have those people, those expertise inside the company. What are we talking about? Differences. So we talked about the assets and the money. Another big issue is politics. Like these projects are so big, like you have to be concerned about politics. I tell people this story often. I was working on a subdivision some years ago. It was like 90 lots, 95 lots. And the property had historically been a school district property, right? So the school had owned it and they were going to build a school at some point, had planned to build a school, but they decided to surplus it and they sold the property off. Well, the neighborhood was pissed. I mean, they were upset. Like, no, this is our property. This is our, school property. And then like for the last 30 years or so, they had been using it as a park and it had maybe 1,300 trees on the site. And I mean, it was just like this community amenity. And stop me if you want me to
pull back on the story.
Okay. But so the subdivision came in and the neighborhood was in a roar. I mean, they pushed back hard. And usually for your single families, nobody cares. You might have a nosy neighbor, you know, who's concerned about the fact that you didn't get a permit. But other than that, no one's really pushing you around and dictating what your outcomes might be. Not the case in commercial real estate. For that particular project, the developer had to retain 30% of the trees on site. So they had to completely redesign the entire plat. They had to do some ridiculous type of spending for grading. And so it just completely changed their bottom line. It changed their soft costs, all because of politics of place. So that's another difference.
Wow.
Yeah. And then similarities. Well, one more difference that I like to highlight for people are permits and entitlements. So, hopefully your folks are going out and getting permits. They may not be getting permits, but hopefully they're going out and getting permits. But in commercial real estate, you have to go through a land use entitlement process. And that happens on the front end before you even get to the building permit stage. And it's a public notice and public process. Each jurisdiction calls it different things, master use permit, environmental review, land use permit, site plan review. It can be a number of different labels, but the concept's still the same. You have to go through this extra step before you actually get into a building permit.
Got it. Yeah. How else have you seen like the political and community side play out and sometimes maybe halt a project or give you a headache?
Oh man, let me think of another project that was controversial. You know what? I have a project that wasn't controversial that you would have thought would have been controversial. It was an IKEA. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it was huge. I mean, they were tearing down an existing IKEA. It was about 350,000 square feet. And they were replacing it with like 400 and maybe 50,000 square feet. Ton of parking, which is usually a big issue when you're creating a whole bunch of impervious surfaces. And that contributes to drainage and all these other things. Like these are things usually people come out for. No one came to that public hearing. That public hearing might have been one of my fastest public hearings, like 5 minutes. No one cared. Wow. No one cared. But that school and those residences, mm-hmm. a thing. I also worked on a strip club at one point. So one of the cities I worked in actually holds the case law for adult entertainment uses and for the United States. They went to the Supreme Court. Wow. And so I worked on one of those. And just because of the public outcry, we were able to kind of dictate how and when they operate. So our adult entertainment law in Washington state is really different than other states.
Got it.
I have all kinds of stories. We could sit here and talk stories all evening. Okay.
Yeah. No, this is great. Wow. That's really interesting. And I guess
you want to know about similarities though, too.
Yeah.
Or no.
Let's talk about some similarities. Okay. Sure.
So similar, or similarities. So certainly for investment class, I mean, it's the same concept, different scale, the same concept. Real estate's going to hold its value. It's one of the best investments around. So in that way, commercial real estate's the same. It's just bigger, you know? Also location. I mean, location matters in real estate, period. Location, location, location. I mean, it should be your primary concern when investing in real estate, whether commercial or residential. And then I would also say, you live and die by your team. Like I'm sure many of your followers and investors know, if you don't have a good contractor and you don't have good labor, you know, your project can die. Good example of this in my industry right now, Microsoft is expanding their campus in Redmond. It's a $5 billion project. So again, that money has to get spent down somewhere.
Right.
And that means they've sucked all of the contractors out of the market, all of the labor, all of the materials. And so everybody's scrapping for really good contractors and, you know, design teams that are all working on this really, really large project. So it leaves us scrambling a little bit, you know, for our own projects and trying to get stuff scheduled. So same concept.
Got it. So also take us back to like the beginning, like when you first got into the industry, was there anything that surprised you, like anything you didn't expect?
That's a really good question. Anything I didn't expect. You know, I didn't expect my pathway to be as easy as it was, to be honest. You know, it was a lot more approachable than I expected. Now, and I don't think everybody's experience is the same. Mine may have been a little bit different, but I was able to approach the industry, you know, kind of commanding my own square. And I didn't expect that. I thought I was going to be, you know, fighting hard to make every single step. And not to say that I didn't have to enter some rooms that were uncomfortable or, you know, address, you know, microaggressions and all the things that people that look like me have to address in predominantly white industries. But it's been fairly easy, to be honest. It wasn't something that I expected.
Definitely. Speaking of like, you know, microaggressions and things like that, what has your experience been as a Black woman in the industry? I'm pretty sure I would assume there's not too many who look like us in the industry. So what's that been like for you?
No, especially in Seattle. So Seattle, I can literally count on one hand the number of Black developers in Seattle, Washington. And we're one of the largest commercial real estate markets right now in the United States in terms of growth because of Amazon and Microsoft and the who's who. And there's only a few of us. So it's always interesting, you know, for people that come into my meetings, you know, they kind of look at me like, is she the one in charge? Like who is she? You know, I tell this story. There's two stories that I tell typically when I'm asked questions like this, but I'll tell you probably my favorite. I was working on a really complicated site. We were acquiring a site, it was a 10-acre site, $15 million acquisition. And it was complicated. It was riddled with easements, covenants. It had access issues. The soils were dirty. Like anything you could think of to be on this site, it was there. So it was complicated. And so we had a meeting. We're already under contract. We're working towards closing. There's all these things to solve. And there's a group of 20 of us. And so my counterpart on the seller's end, you know, he's head man in charge. He's used to, you know, kind of controlling the room. So he comes in and I'm facilitating the meeting. And so we start. And I know the concepts are complicated. So I start with a couple of easy concepts, get, you know, the momentum going in terms of problem solving. Then I go to something complex and then I come back to something more simple. And I did this dance and he watched me. And at some point he kind of leaned up and he looked over at me. He said, "You're good." And because for me, it was so much validation because I saw his face when he saw me start to leave the meeting. And since then, we keep in touch. The deal closed, you know, we were able to resolve all the complex issues. So I kind of welcome it. There's always that time where they kind of have to acknowledge that, you know, there's somebody like me here and I have value to add, you know?
Definitely. I like that. What's your day to day like these days as far as
work? Oh, God. No one day is the same. I said that earlier. COVID changed my days a lot. So right now, the asset that we are currently kind of closing out on, I mentioned, is a $1 billion asset. So we have 383 multifamily units on site. We have a 347 room Hyatt Regency. with 60,000 square feet of conferencing space. And then we have 730,000 square feet of Class A office. And so for the last year or so, it's been challenging. Our residential has been performing well, thankfully. Our retail has been performing well. The hotel, different story, obviously. Yeah. You know, it's been challenging. We have a lot of conferencing space. We haven't been able to put on conferences. So we do a lot of triaging there. And then our 730,000 square feet actually is sitting vacant. And so we spend a lot of time trying to find a tenant who's willing to sign on the dotted line for what is essentially a really large lease. You know, we're talking $350 to $400 million lease. Wow. For 10 years. And so that's really challenging to go out to market during this time. So that's what we spend a lot of our days doing, is entertaining potential tenants. And then I spend a lot of time acquiring land. So making offers, doing due diligence, and then trying to maintain our relationships, both with government, the industry, and the community.
Got it.
Today's inspirational quote of the day is from Majora Carter. If we are going to be part of the solution, we have to engage the problems. Now, I love this quote for many reasons. I believe in being a solutions-oriented person, not dwelling on the problems, but thinking about what you can contribute to improving something, even if it's just a little bit. And I believe real estate is one of the best ways to improve things, to improve the state of things in our community. You know, buying a home, buying a property in a community to where we mostly are, to live or to rent out to someone, fixing the property, making sure it's well maintained, it can bring dignity back to a block, dignity back to a family or individual living in that particular property. Pulling our resources together to do things such as what one of our podcast alumni, Chris Senegal, has done to revitalize and restore certain parts of Houston. There's power in numbers. There's a lot of things we can do. We may not be able to fix the whole problem, but there's something you can do. So think about a problem in your community. Think about a problem, other areas of your life where you can do something to help move the needle forward. You may not be able to fix everything, but I guarantee you, you can do something.
So you mentioned like buying land and other transactions. When you think about the next project or the next parcel of land to develop on, like, how do you evaluate, all right, we want to build X here, or we want to build X there, or we want to like see what the possibilities are? What's that process like?
Oh man, it's different for every project, right? Yeah. I mean, you're doing your due diligence. I mean, that's really what you're doing. And whether it's for a residential project or a commercial project, you know, you have a lot of stones to turn over, right? For a commercial project, I'm not going to be able to list all of them, mm-hmm. but I'll probably call out some differences that you wouldn't look at in residential. So one, got to look at the soils. Are the soils dirty or not, right? Because if the soils are dirty, depending on the type of use that was there before, was there a dry cleaner there? Was there a gas station? Was there a manufacturing facility there? And not just, you know, 10 years ago, 100 years ago, sometimes there'll be uses that have contaminated the soils. Wow. And that really impacts your ability to finance a project, right? So we certainly look at soils. And then also it increases your liability because you may be responsible for cleaning the dirt, and that takes a lot of time and a lot of money. We do a very thorough job on researching the title, right? All of the encumbrances, easements or covenants. We've gotten bit before by a hidden covenant somewhere deep, deep, deep down in 700 pages of title documents that restricted a potential use on the site, which meant that we could no longer build that use. And we were actually considering building the use on that site. And it was buried down in a ridiculous number of pages. So, you know, that's something that we pay a ton of attention to. We spend a lot of time doing highest and best use evaluations. Like, we are a mixed use developer. So we do residential, we do office, we do hospitality. So we'll have a full on design team, architect, engineer, you know, you have it, traffic, geotech, structural, come in on the front end and actually do massing studies and infrastructure assessments to determine what's its highest and best use. You know, how tall can we build? How many units can we build? How many square feet can we build? How many parking spaces? And then what else did you ask for? What did we look at?
I think that was a good summary.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's so much, you know, like you saw one of my checklist for due diligence on a commercial site. I mean, there's a lot to be done. For example, you know, a due diligence on, you know, a residential project may only, a contingency period may be a week. You know, you're going to do an inspection, an appraisal, and get your financing in order. For us, that contingency period is going to be 60 days, 90 days. You know, you're going to have a really long period because there's a lot to be done. I mean, you're really turning over a lot of stones.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's wild. So your checklist, how many pages do you think, would you say on top of your head, it might be depending on like the project?
Pages? Oh, well, the checklist itself might be like on a 11 by 17, right? But in like a spreadsheet, you know, with maybe 100 different sales, but those sales represent, like if I'm working with an architect that's going to be, you know, doing a massing study on a particular site, that might be a 2-month process with, you know, 10 different meetings, you know, while we're fine tuning the programming and moving things around. Or, for example, the environmental analysis on the soils, like that's significant dollars, significant money. So all of those little sales represent huge chunks of time and money.
Definitely. How does the company get the capital to deploy for these projects?
It's a really good question. It's different for different companies, right? Different approaches. And there are a lot of companies whose whole business model is based on how they finance the project and the margins in there, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, some people self-finance. I'm not a huge advocate of that because the projects are so big. Not many people have $1 billion to, you know, self-finance a project. But, you know, if you have a $5 million, you know, multifamily project that's, you know, 50 units, in our market, that would be more like 25 units to build, maybe even a little bit less, depending on where you are. But if you have the money, you could, you know, self-finance. A lot of people like to pull in equity partners. You might find a family that wants to diversify their portfolio or has holdings in real estate, and they're willing to, you know, fund you, or other equity partners that have money. You can go to traditional banks, you know, and you're going to have some skin in the game, a lot more skin than you would in a residential project. There's hard money lenders in commercial real estate. They're going to charge you a significant amount of interest, but they do exist. And then there are also institutions. I mean, you know, large institutions that have significant holdings that just want, you know, a certain return on their investment or a certain cap rate. And they're also willing to come into the deal, usually as debt, not usually as an equity partner.
Got it. And what is the difference between like a debt and equity partner?
So like it's almost like, Don't think of a partner, right? Just think of equity, right? When you go and you put down however many dollars into a residential project, that represents your equity in the project, right? And then you go and you get a mortgage, which is debt, right? And all that mortgage lender wants is their interest rate return, right? They don't need a piece of your project. They don't care what you make or don't make on the back end. They don't care about any of that. They are a debt provider, right? So in this same case, you might go get, you know, different types of groups, whether that's a family, whether that's an individual, other investor, it doesn't matter. But those folks will become essentially equity partners in that they'll put their own skin in the game. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to negotiate who gets what splits on the end. Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
And a lot of times the way the deals come together is you'll have, you know, a group of equity partners. Maybe it's a single person, maybe it's more. And then you usually take that equity and then you go leverage it to go get debt. Usually.
That makes sense. What are some of your favorite projects that you worked on?
Oh man. Well, of course I have to name the project I'm sitting in. I mean, it's such a substantial project. We have some really cool elements here. For your followers, if you want to check it out, it's southport.life is the website. And it's just a really unique project. We're pioneering a whole brand new market for Class A office here. So there's hasn't existed Class A office in this particular submarket. We have 600 linear feet of waterfront. So you can pull up your boat and park your boat on Lake Washington and, you know, come in and eat and stay at the hotel. And I mean, it just has all of these really cool amenities. And then also it just has a ton of runway. So in the last 15 months, we've acquired another 15 acres to expand. So that's going to represent another probably $1.5 to $2 billion worth of investment going forward. So I think just because of the scale and the fact that it's changing the complexion of the surrounding neighborhood, it's probably my favorite.
Definitely. That's awesome. And what's it like just, you know, sitting in the project you're in now or driving around and seeing things you worked on? What is that experience like? Like what goes through your mind just considering, you know, how much you've worked to get to this point?
Can I pop my collar on your podcast?
Yeah, you definitely can. You definitely can.
No. It's just rewarding. Like, there's just so many places that I drive down where I can see, like, you know, that's me right there. That's my hand right there. I can see it. It's just rewarding. It's just the best way to put it. Especially when the spaces feel good and they bring people together and they enhance people's quality of life. Like, there's nothing like that for me personally. Now, there are some blocks that I won't drive now that I messed up in my early career. There's some blocks I will not drive down.
Yeah.
But in general, I love seeing my hand in the environment.
Definitely. What are some lessons you would say you've learned during your career?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I mean, that's essentially it. There are blocks that I won't drive down because I messed up something so bad. Probably my most, the one that sticks out in my mind, it isn't the biggest project. It was early in my career and it was a Starbucks. Okay. And it was a change of use. They were changing a Arby's into a Starbucks. And they had a drive-through lane, and they're used to the drive-through lane being like Arby's. You know, you might have 5-6 cars, not a drive lane for a drive-through lane for Starbucks, where you have 10 cars, you know, in queue or 15 cars in queue. And it is the worst drive-through for Starbucks in all of the Seattle area. And it's because I didn't pay attention to the stacking. So basically the lengths of cars in the drive-through lane. And I still go there and get coffee sometimes and shake my head. But I think the point that I learned was that just the details matter. Like, even no matter how big these projects are, if you're not combing down into the weeds, you can really get bitten. For example, if I hadn't read those 700 pages of documents, which sounds ridiculous, but it's necessary. And you have other people reading, you have people, you know, looking past your shoulder. But if I hadn't read through that and really dug deep to find that CCNR, I mean, we would have purchased a property that we wouldn't have been able to use as we intended, you know? So yeah, the details matter. That's the biggest lesson I've learned.
Definitely.
Today's real estate definition of the day is closing cost. Closing costs are the fees paid at the end of a real estate transaction. The fees vary depending on where you live, the property you buy, and the type of loan that you choose. There are costs associated with inspections, transfer of title, loan origination fees, etc.
So if someone is looking at commercial real estate, let's say from like an investment perspective, let's just say for the sake of the example, like a large multifamily, and they're trying to figure out, all right, I have this money or I've raised this money, whatever the case is, I need to figure out where to deploy it. Like, how do they figure out, all right, this is a hot market or this is a place I should invest? Like, I guess, what are a couple of indicators someone should look at in that case?
Marcus, so one, I would say your knowledge of the market is going to be number one, right? Just, it's hard to, and I've heard you say this a couple of times where people are asking basically, how do you invest outside of your tradition, you know, outside of your space in a market that's geographically away from you. And of course, it's possible. I mean, people do it every day. Large investors do it every day. I mean, you don't have to be there and be present. But there is something about having a very nuanced understanding of a neighborhood and a market that adds a ton of value. You can assess your risk differently. You know, you have a good indication of values and market where you might not in other places. So that's one. I would say certainly having an understanding of the market. Two, you want some predictability. Good example is this is Seattle hasn't really been the most predictable of a political environment. Like, for example, the head tax is probably what most people know about when it comes to Seattle. There's been a new head tax on Amazon. So that creates a lot of what's the best word to describe? It doesn't become predictable. You can't rely on continued investment here. You can't rely on job growth potentially because these large employers don't want to be where they're not welcomed by, you know, these city governments. And so they look for other places. Well, then that changes the complexion of other asset classes beyond office, like multifamily and hotels and stuff like that, because the employment's not there. So another attribute would be employment. Like, you want jobs. You want it to have a really good, diverse job base. So not just one single factory, but you have different industries there that if one falls off, the other one can shore up. What did I say? Politics, employment. Oh, and talent pool. Like, you got to have people, you know, smart people, you know, and usually where there are smart people, employers want to be. And that's really the best synergy there. To become an investor, I would say those are probably good indicators. I mean, there's more, but I would say to look for those in a market.
Definitely. And from your perspective, just being in the industry in the Seattle area, what changes have you seen like during that time? Like how have things grown and developed since you started?
Man, it's been a roller coaster. I mean, you know, I grew up in Seattle, so I'm in my older 30s, you know, like I'm almost over that hill into 40. So 35 years ago, Seattle was just a completely different place. And when you started to see, I mean, we still had Boeing, which was a huge employer here, and Weyerhaeuser and some other big names that were really kind of holding the market steady. But that boom, like late 90s, all the way up until now with Microsoft and Amazon and Starbucks and now Facebook and T-Mobile. I mean, we just have so many different employers. And some people would probably describe it as a prosperity bomb, because it really kind of just goes off and it gentrifies a lot of neighborhoods. The neighborhood I grew up in doesn't look the same at all. For our industry, though, it has created a huge energy boost, and it's just been nonstop all the way up basically until COVID. And then when we started to see the politics change, even right before COVID, we started to see folks thinking about leaving like the urban core of Seattle. And that's now starting to change. So it'll be interesting to see how we recover and whether folks will actually go back into our urban core or look for other opportunities out on the fringes.
Got it. That makes sense. And I guess how we touched on it a bit earlier, but has the company's strategy or what your strategy is for your role, has that changed significantly, would you say, during COVID or slightly?
Yeah, I don't know if it's because of COVID necessarily or if it's because of other trends like we're seeing, and maybe they kind of dovetail. We're really focused on healthier buildings. This has become very important for many end users, whether they're hotels or residential or even office users. And we've been lucky that we had a lot of those kind of attributes in our development. We had optimal windows in all of our buildings. We have a lot of open space and we sit right on a lake and adjacent to a park. So we have kind of this room to breathe. We have really good building systems. But as we're moving forward, we're starting to think about things like carbon neutral microgrids, you know, especially with some of the things that have recently happened, and finding ways to dovetail energy into our developments. Also, the trends in terms of smart cities and like integrating technology into our building systems and the built environment, we think will create smarter places for people. So we've started to look at creating those spaces in our programming. So they kind of dovetail because of COVID, but it's more about technology than it would be about COVID. I think COVID, we're just all trying to brace, yeah. You know, And hopefully we can write this thing out and return back to a place of normalcy here soon.
Definitely. Definitely. Do you think you'll ever end up doing your own development projects in the future?
Oh, yeah, of course. Oh, yeah. I want a piece of the pie.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I intend on developing. I'm actually looking at a JV opportunity a joint venture opportunity for folks that don't know. So I'm looking at a JV opportunity right now for a multifamily project that I would be an equity partner on and developer. And then I have my own real estate holdings. I don't know that I would ever really want to work on this scale of project on my own. Just the political implications. I don't know. I mean, I can do it for somebody else, but if it's my $1 billion on the line, I'm a little bit more married to the outcome. Yeah. I mean, I'm married to the outcome on behalf of my boss. You know, of course I'm out championing to make sure the project's successful. But yeah, I'm not going to let you play with my coin like that. You know, there's just too many political implications. So I would probably stick to smaller projects if they're my own.
Got it. That makes sense. So it seems like the political aspect of it is something people really need to understand is like a thing.
I mean, you live and die by those entitlements. Really, the biggest value that you get in a commercial project is that entitlement, like the biggest bump in valuation. Because when you buy a piece of raw land, it's just land. There's nothing there. You can't do anything with it. And once you get those land use entitlements and you get the city to actually agree to the concept, all you're really working out in the building permit is, you know, the actual construction documents, right? But the use itself and to establish that use has a significant amount of value to it. And the only way to get to that other side is through a city. And it's usually a public process, you know, and the city's inviting people that care about the color of brick you're adding to the building. And, you know, like it can be one thing or another. I mean, I have all kinds of war stories. I wish I could have thought of another one. That subdivision was... It was challenging. But yeah, I was actually recently working. I don't know if I can even share this. Maybe I won't give too many details, but I was recently working with a potential developer that was wanting to build 1,300 units, I think, in a city. And the city passed an emergency ordinance requiring that they construct several hundred thousands of square feet of retail space. And if you know anything about developing multifamily, underwriting a ton of retail space is very, very challenging. Usually lenders are cool with residential or cool with retail space, but when you combine those food groups, especially at that magnitude, it's not, it's usually pretty challenging. And they usually don't work out. You know, people don't occupy that much retail space. And so they're kind of halted right now. What do they do? You know, this is where your land use attorneys really get paid big bucks, you know, to come in and try to help navigate you through the entitlement process.
Got it. Got it. So, you know, I'm really excited about this interview because it's a great exposure for our community. A lot of us, you know, we have different jobs and such and just different ideal jobs, right, that we're supposed to strive towards. But I know for sure when I grew up, I didn't know anything about real estate development. I just saw buildings, but I didn't know you could work and actually be part of that.
Right.
So, you know, let's say, you know, you have someone who's listening to this episode. Maybe they've thought about it or someone told them about it or they have some kind of interest. But hearing this, it kind of is like, OK, this is really what I want to do. What advice would you give to someone in that position who's interested in seeing if they can get into the field somehow?
Yeah, it's another good question. You know, it's interesting. I feel like, and this is probably one of my personal pet peeves because people approach me sometimes and I'm like, man, I want to do what you do. I'm like, oh, really? and I would ask, like, why? You know, like, what is your why? Like, if it's just simply to make money, then just be an investor. You know, our landscape, our industry is competitive, right? And so if you're just bringing an appetite to make money, you might want to stay at home because you're competing against people like me and others who are bringing some skill sets. You know what I'm saying? So what's your why? If it's just about making money, you can be a passive investor in commercial real estate and make a good return, really, if you get coupled up with the right partners. So that would be one, is figure out your why. And if your why is whatever good reason you feel is right for you, then you need to figure out what function you want to play. Do you want to be a developer, or do you want to be a land use attorney? You know, do you want to be on the lending side and figuring out how to underwrite the projects? Or do you want to help design the projects and be an architect? Like, there's so many functions in commercial real estate. Like, I think you have to figure out where you want to play. And then once you figure that out, then you just gotta go get the skills. Like, it's to me, it's like a brand new language. You know, any industry, anything you're trying to break into, you have to learn the language. So, you know, that's easier said than done. There's not really a school that's out there that's going to teach you commercial real estate or programs like that. So a lot of research, podcasts like this or others, pick up your business journals. Most large cities have business journals that discuss the different real estate transactions that are occurring. Familiarize yourself with the terms, familiarize yourself with the different assets, how they're transacting, what's important. And then the last thing is, of course, networking. Like, you kind of have to put yourself out there. I mean, I believe in mentors. I have a few mentors and I have a few mentees that I mentor. But I think even more than that, our whole industry is relationship based. So you just kind of have to put your face out there, you know?
Definitely. So what does the future look like? What do you think about for yourself, when you think about like what you might want to be doing down the road?
It's a good question. You know what's funny? I do this for myself, and now I have a lot of my friends doing it, and they use my template. But I actually have a 1-year plan, 5-year plan, and 10-year plan that I've been doing for years, and it's kind of followed this trajectory. I always have to think a little bit bigger, you know, but I've broken it down into several different phases, starting with faith at the very top, and then family, friends, finances. Occupation sits down here, you know, giving back and volunteering is up there. So if it's just about my occupation, of course, I want to be developing. I'd probably like to be right around that $100 million asset class, like nothing this big, but, you know, grow my asset class a little bit bigger, work on 150 unit projects, multifamily mostly. I could dabble in industrial because it's a hot market right now.
Yeah.
But mainly multifamily. But I would say I'm more focused on the rest of those parts of my life, you know, and even finance is up there. So, you know, if the bread's right, you know, I might be operating, I might be doing something different right there. But starting with my faith, you know, and just trusting that it, wherever I go, if I step out on faith, that God's going to make up the rest in favor, you know?
Definitely. I like that. You know, I think, what I like about what you mentioned there is, you know, you mentioned all the other things, and then you mentioned, like, you know, finances, occupation. I really think there's a lot people can grasp from that, because, you know, without those things you mentioned first, your career and finance, all those things, is very unlikely that it's going to go as planned if you don't have that foundation. So I think it's great that you mentioned that.
Or that it's going to be rewarding, you know, like, you want to build your foundation in a way. Like, to me, it just, money comes and goes, you know, your work path and occupation changes direction many times. And, you know, but those faith, family, friends, like, I mean, those are foundational elements for me, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's been something that I've used as a guide for many years.
Definitely. So if we were to have you come back, what are some things you might want to touch on?
Yeah, because we talked about this, like, there's just so much to talk about, you know, and I might not be the right person for each topic, but I think if your followers are really interested in digging a little bit deeper into commercial real estate, there are a couple of things. To me, the natural jump from residential is to multifamily in terms of an asset class. So how do you make a smooth transition from single family into multifamily, or leapfrog into that? We could talk about entitlements. As I mentioned, getting those land use permits are really like your bread and butter. And figuring out how to strategically do that. Like, most people are familiar with zoning and what zoning means. You know, how do you amplify that one more step to really create value for your assets, right? So that's something we could talk about, raising capital. We could talk about the impact commercial real estate has on single family. Like, you might want to understand, if for nothing else, you want to understand the commercial real estate market just to see how it drives your market. Sorry, then shut us down. You'll edit this out. Can you edit it out? Okay.
Yeah.
But I don't know where to even go back to. So as a driver for commercial real estate, like for residential, commercial real estate is a huge part of what drives the residential market. And so just having that understanding and knowledge is only going to make you so much more effective at your residential projects. And then networking as an outsider, I can come back and talk about that. New to a city and just understanding like zoning and infrastructure, water, sewer, drainage, those things that really matter for large projects, come and talk about that. There's so much to talk about. If you wanted me back, or I could introduce others that I know in the industry that might be a better fit if they want to talk about retail or industrial, happy to do so.
Perfect. Perfect. I appreciate it. And where can people find you if they like to connect with you or just keep up with what you have going on? Where would be the best place to reach you?
Yeah, I would probably say LinkedIn is, well, no, that's not the best. I'm not on there as often as I should be, but I am on LinkedIn. I am on LinkedIn. I'm on IG. So I'm on LinkedIn as my name, Raquel Timmons. And then IG, I'm at Oracle, O-R-A-C-L-E _ Raquel. And so I'm on IG, and then I'm also on Facebook. I don't really use Facebook that often, and I'm not really a Twitter girl yet. You know, I don't do tweets. Not yet.
Yeah, awesome. Awesome. And do you have anything you want to leave with the listeners?
No, just only that if you're in residential, you already kind of have the basics in terms of understanding real estate. And that leap is big, but it's certainly doable. And if you are inspired to do so, make the leap, you know, make the leap. And just trust, like I said before, it's my motto, step out on faith, God makes up the rest in favor, you know, and I believe that. And so, that's what I would leave your listeners with.
Awesome. Awesome. I mean, this has been a great interview. I've learned a whole lot. Like, I've just been sitting back like a student and having around myself.
And now you're getting some of my personality, because I'll take over something in a quick minute. I don't even know if it's usually more of a dialogue or not. So I apologize.
No, you're good. You're good. I was just sitting back learning and reminding myself this is an interview. I appreciate it. And I know, our listeners will get a whole lot of value out of it and exposure to something new. So I really appreciate you coming on.
For sure. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. Awesome. And thank you everyone for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. If you'd like to keep up with what we have going on, text BRED to 21,000. If you'd like to support us as an official patron, go to patreon.com/blackrealestatedialogue. If you'd like to join our community, go to blackrealestatedialogue.com and you can find all of our resources. I look forward to hearing from you all soon.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. Remember to follow us on Instagram at Black Real Estate Dialogue and on Twitter at Bread Podcast. That's BRED Podcast. Until next time. You've reached the end of the show. Thanks so much for listening. We value your time, and that's why we want to give you the best sounding, best produced quality of content we possibly can. And this podcast you've been listening to has been edited and produced by yours truly. I'm Donald the Voice. I'm a 10-year voiceover artist, narrator, and production specialist that wants to see only the best, life-giving, equipping, and long-lasting content be produced to help others. So if you have commercial, video editing, or other production needs, I'd love to talk with you. That's right. Visit DonaldTheVoice.com and hit the contact page to talk about how we can work together to bring your content to life. Okay, so you're not an email person. Well, you can also contact me on Instagram at DonaldTheVoice or on Facebook.com/Donald.TheVoice. I'm looking forward to talking to you.
What? What is... Dax, are you...
Tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker on all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes, I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all, so we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge, trucks up 3.9%.
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.